From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. No one ever claimed helicopters were the safest way to get around in a war. But when an American chopper went down near Baghdad on Wednesday, it was at the top of the news, both in print and on the air.
With Brian Williams.
Good evening. On top of all the various dangers facing U.S. fighters in Iraq, tonight seven more Americans are dead in another helicopter crash.
This is World News with Charles Gibson.
Good evening. Today in Iraq, another chopper down. In 4 years
on board, insurgents say they shot it down. The U.S. military, however, isn't so sure. Still, is it part of a disturbing new pattern?
It's hard to argue that it isn't news when, in all, six choppers go down in 3 weeks. But we've noticed that whenever a helicopter crashes in Iraq, it seems to garner more headlines than almost any other kind of attack. And it's not simply a matter of casualties. Improvised explosive devices were responsible for more American deaths over that same three-week period. And so, as media watchers, we had to ask ourselves why the story resonates so loudly here. We called Mark Bowden to help us find an answer. He, of course, is the reporter who wrote the book Black Hawk Down about the failed American military campaign in Somalia. It was later made into a movie. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Brooke.
So I guess one of the unintended consequences of Black Hawk Down is that you've effectively been branded the go-to guy on helicopter crashes.
It's true. Whenever a Black Hawk goes down anywhere in the world, I get called.
So would you agree that helicopter crashes seem to be getting a lot of attention here that is perhaps out of proportion with the actual losses they inflict?
I think that it is an arresting image, certainly, in part because helicopters are a set of visual symbols of American technological superiorities. Probably the distinct advantage that American forces have over any other military in the world is that we are capable of completely controlling the skies. And that's something that's felt not just from a distance, but by the soldiers in Iraq or Afghanistan, who would much prefer to travel from place to place on a helicopter than in a vehicle. The vehicles are considered to be far more vulnerable. So it's a blow to America's sense of invulnerability.
You mentioned the symbolism. Do you think helicopters are actually a symbol of the superpower?
They are, and for the same reason it alarms us when helicopters are shot down, it heartens the enemy. In Somalia, the primary tactic that the Klansmen in Mogadishu employed was to target helicopters. They shot down five or six helicopters in the day of the Battle of Mogadishu with rocket-propelled grenades. And that was a very alarming event to the American soldiers on the ground who had been lulled by their previous successes into a belief that the relatively primitive soldiery that they faced was not really capable of taking down a helicopter.
And I guess it's worth noting that the downing of Soviet helicopters in Afghanistan in the 80s has been invoked by journalists and pundits on more than a few occasions this week as the turning point in that war.
I think it's true. I mean, it's a classic David versus Goliath situation.
Have helicopters always represented military superiority, mastery in the sky? I mean, everybody remembers the Coppola Wagnerian dun 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 as they came pouring across the landscape in Apocalypse Now.
You know, I think that's actually the first image that comes to my mind of helicopters as really menacing attack vehicles, at least in popular culture. I think that helicopters in the real world, even in the context of Vietnam, I think primarily of ways of sort of inserting troops and also pulling out the wounded and getting them to a hospital really quickly. So in that sense, I didn't really perceive of helicopters as assault vehicles until that famous image from Apocalypse Now.
I guess you have to wonder, is the insurgency primarily sending a message? Trafficking in the meanings they know will play powerfully to the American people and their own people rather than, you know, just carrying out a strictly tactical campaign.
I think without question that's true, Brooke. I mean, the insurgency has from the beginning been primarily about creating images and death tolls that will shock the American public and will shatter our country's resolve. That's the nature of any insurgency, really, is to demoralize a more powerful opponent. And so these images, I think that they are sought for the same reason that they videotape their executions of prisoners and put them up on the internet.
So just another salvo in a war that is being fought not just on the ground, but in the media space.
I think that's been the nature of all these conflicts that we've been involved in for the last 10 or 15 years.
Mark, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Brooke.
Mark Bowden is a national correspondent for the Atlantic Monthly and, starting again this weekend, a columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
Last Sunday, the Iraqi branch of al-Qaeda reportedly took credit for the video of a downed Apache helicopter posted on an Islamist website, accompanied by verses from the Quran. We seem to be awash in images from the theater of war, but the horror seems to come closer with each new video. Late last month, Damien Cave, a New York Times reporter embedded in Iraq, captured the death of a soldier on video. It was posted on the paper's website. A warning about this audio, it's pretty raw.
Somebody fucking talk to me!
Somebody, I'm fucking hit in the head!
Is he down?
In the head, yes,
sir. Is he fucking breathing?
Sergeant Leha, the squad leader, has been hit, possibly by a sniper. It's a horrible scene.
Huh? Well, let's drag him in here.
Can we get him in there?
Apparently, Sergeant Leha's family did not know of the existence of the photos and video before they were published, and now the embed status of the Times reporter and a Getty photographer is unclear. But Fox News Watch commentator Cal Thomas enjoyed complete clarity.
I think not only having the picture and the name of the person, but the whole dying process is obscene. It's certainly insensitive to the family. Times put out a statement saying, you know, they apologize for any hurt caused. Well, that's like shooting somebody and say, while they're dying, hey, I'm sorry I killed you and you're not feeling well.
Meanwhile, his liberal Fox News Watch counterpart Neil Gabler had doubt enough for all.
I think this is a very tough call because I think that journalists have a moral responsibility to the family, obviously, to be sensitive. But they have a professional responsibility to report the news. And there is a public interest here. I don't think that families can be given veto power over the kinds of images that are shown.
There was at least general agreement that Sergeant Leha's death on Haifa Street in Baghdad was horrific and tragic. There was no doubt about that. After all, verified recordings of events are supposed to end arguments over what happened.
But not always. Another recording has emerged this week. This one captured a case of friendly fire shortly after the invasion of Iraq in 2003. In this cockpit recording, we hear American pilots argue over whether a prospective target is foe or friend. Ground control says there are no friends in the area, so they fire on what turns out to be a British convoy. Ignorant of what they've done, they briefly congratulate themselves on the hit. Then they learn the truth, and that a British soldier was killed.
I'm gonna be sick. Peter?
Yeah, this sucks.
We're in jail, dude.
How do they sound to you? To our ears, shattered. But not to British columnist Alexander Chancellor, who wrote in Friday's Guardian that, quote, "The Americans were sorry to have killed British Lance Corporal Matty Hall in Iraq, but you get the feeling that they were not quite sorry enough. There is no act more grave than killing people, but the Americans seem to shrug it off with alarming ease, at least when those who die are not Americans." People who oppose the invasion have learned to distinguish between those who declared war and those sent to fight it. But would we be as enraged at British soldiers if they fired on our troops? Would we, like the British media this week, call them trigger-happy? Would we call them cowboys? Those words are often applied to our president overseas. Now it seems his voice has drowned out those of the anguished pilots. It drowns out the evidence of their remorse. The tape cannot redeem them in the face of so much loss.
We had quite a few responses to our interview with sociologist Jerry Lemke about exaggerated accounts of spitting on soldiers during wars, especially the Vietnam War. His research suggested it was largely a myth. But John Miller writes, quote, "Thought you might find this interesting. A law professor at Northwestern named Jim Lindgren has debunked Lemke by going through archives and finding many stories documenting spat upon veterans in the 60s and 70s, including a front-page New York Times story by James Reston."
Julia Evans wrote in to say that her brother spent two tours of duty in Vietnam, and when he returned, an older man approached him in the San Francisco airport and spat on his uniform. She continues, quote, "I do not think that at the time these acts meant that we could have won if everyone supported it. What it meant was simply that we felt shame. I realize that Mr. Lemke is not saying that they didn't happen. However, I don't want others to think that they were all myth. My brother went over there in a fog of patriotism and idealism, even though the rest of the family, by the time he enlisted, were against that war, especially our father. My brother told me later that he never realized our father was against the war. I'm just glad he came home alive."
And we received this from Specialist Pete Joyce, who identifies himself as an infantryman in the Army, currently serving a tour in Baghdad. He writes, quote, "I've heard countless claims from war buddies that they got spat at after their last deployment, but it never happened to me, and I've never witnessed it personally. Aside from the handful of Americans who lie on the fringe of political ideology, both spitters and Fox News enthusiasts, I want to voice my support for all of those at home who continue to be passionate and active citizens. There is nothing more American than voicing your opinion, whether it be in protest of the war or in support of current policy. Thank you, protesters, for preserving our America at home while we soldiers fight to protect it abroad."
And thank all of you who wrote in to us. Keep us clued in at onthemedia@wnyc.org, and don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name.
Up next, America's mayor is in the campaign mode, but he's from Brooklyn. Can he be made over into America's president?
This is On the Media from NPR. If you can hear me right now, then you're listening to the podcast. And since you listen on your own schedule, you might like our newsletter because it gives a quick summary of what we're covering each week. You can sign up at onthemedia.org.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The media love parsing the president's words after his State of the Union address, but they're much less entranced by the much more important ritual that follows a few weeks later. I refer, of course, to the arrival of the president's proposed federal budget. Who can blame them? Parsing numbers is a long, hard slog, especially when they're tucked into a 2,500-page behemoth of a book that is virtually unreadable. Every year, between the time the White House offers its version and Congress counters with its own, reporters struggle to find the story in the bickering over tax cuts, revenue streams, and deficit spending. And every year, economist Dean Baker shakes his head at the results. He's the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, and he says most budget stories lose average readers in a bewildering thicket of millions, billions, and trillions.
Basically, unless you're a budget wonk, you hear that we're spending, you know, $460 billion on the defense budget next year. That doesn't mean anything to you. It could be $460 million. It could be $4.6 trillion. These are not terms you're used to.
So what's a reporter to do?
Put these numbers in context so that would be meaningful for people. If you put those numbers as a percent of the budget, people would immediately know this is a big deal or it's a small deal. So if you're talking about the defense budget, President Bush is proposing $480 billion for next year. Tell your readers that's 17% of the budget.
Isn't it nearly twice as much as that? 700 and something if you add in the supplemental?
If you add that in, yes, yes. And then in that case, you're talking about somewhere in the order of about 23, 24% of the budget. But in any case, you know, those are numbers that immediately say, okay, this is a big deal. Public opinion polls regularly show that people think that programs like welfare and foreign aid account for a very large share, or even the majority of the budget, when in reality, even if you interpret welfare programs very liberally, you're only talking about 4%, at most 5% of the budget. Foreign aid is less than a half of 1% of the budget. And that's the sort of thing that if we just had better reporting, people would at least understand this is not a big deal in terms of their tax dollar. And they may still think it's a bad way to spend the money, but they would know that's not going to affect what they have to pay every April 15th.
I brought up the fact that the Defense Department appropriation request is actually much larger than it appears because it seems sometimes reporters don't add the relevant numbers together. And when the president submits a budget, if he breaks it up into a lot of little pieces, it doesn't look as big as it actually is.
Well, that's right. I mean, there's a lot of tricks that have gone on with the budget. So certainly the way the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq have been paid for primarily through supplemental appropriations makes it very difficult for people to understand how much is going to defense and those wars. Another thing that comes up all the time, it's certainly already been discussed to some extent in the context of this budget, they assume revenue based on the idea that the alternative minimum tax is never changed, the formula for it's never changed. I won't go into detail about that. But the implicit assumption there is that you'd have very large tax increases on middle-income families that almost no one thinks will actually take place.
But you do find experts challenging the president's projections in most stories.
You can find them. You have to look. And it's not in most stories. It's in some stories. And even there, the question is it put in a framework that I think people could understand? Now, some of that, you could lay the blame on the experts that, you know, they could try to put this in wording that people would understand. But I think that reporters are inclined to treat anything that comes from the administration as sort of being, at least on a prima facie basis, credible. Doesn't mean that they never challenge it. But until there's, you know, some sort of serious effort, usually by the leadership of the other party, to question it, you know, it's basically accepted pretty much at face value.
Now, your criticisms are pretty much coming from the left, it's fair to say. Do you feel that this is just bowing to power or laziness, or what's the problem?
I'd say the two go together, that it's the easiest thing to do. You know, get the number on the page and write it down. So it's a bit of laziness, and it is a bit of bowing to power that, you know, if you do something, you know, you're calling the White House to account on their budget numbers, it's stepping out of line that can get you in trouble. Now, sometimes they do that, but the easiest thing to do is just do what was done last year, do what everyone else is doing.
So front and center in all of the budget reporting this week has been the issue of the federal deficit. Do you think people are getting an accurate picture of that aspect of the story?
I think people actually are not very clear at all on the federal deficit. I think people are caught up in a debate that, you know, really is much more theatrics than substance. And again, they don't have the means to assess that. So they could hear, on the one hand, President Bush saying, you know, I just put out a budget proposal that has my tax cuts continuing in 2012, and it still has a surplus that year. They can have the Democrats correctly say that's not true, because if we look at, you know, some of your numbers more closely, we won't have a surplus. But then the underlying question is, okay, how big a deal is that deficit in 2012? Well, it's actually probably not that big a deal.
Dean, you have really rocked my world right now, because everyone I know says that the deficit is a huge problem. It's being financed by China. If China stops financing it, the entire country will collapse. And you're telling me it's not that big of a deal?
Well, actually, what's interesting about what's being financed by China is financing our trade deficit. Our trade deficit last year was over $800 billion compared to our budget deficit, which was about $270 billion. Now, the big deal in that story, in fact, is the trade deficit, almost three times the size of the budget deficit, which gets very little attention, usually devoted to page three of the business section.
So if you want to get hysterical about a deficit, look at the trade deficit, not the budget deficit.
Well, again, it's simple numbers, three times the size.
Dean Baker is co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He blogs about economic reporting on the American Prospects website. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Oh, thanks a lot.
Another week, another presidential hopeful nearly says he's in.
He's inching closer. Tonight, Rudolph Giuliani takes a new step on the road he hopes stretches from New York to the White House.
A little further into the story, NBC's Brian Williams pops the big question.
Can he convert his popularity in the wake of national disaster to attempt to carry him all the way to the White House?
Williams is a national newsman, but more significantly, he's a national newsman based in New York, the site of the national disaster that made Giuliani's run for the presidency possible. Fact is, once it was not possible. As America's mayor, he is a media darling. As New York City's mayor, he was a media brat. Jason Horowitz covers politics for the New York Observer.
It's fair to say he had a rather antagonistic relationship with New York's press corps, and he was known as somebody who would push back and like to, you know, give and take with the reporters and didn't take much from them. And since September 11th, he hasn't really encountered that again. So I guess the question is, when his campaign really goes into full gear, what type of New York press is he going to be facing? Is he going to be facing the pre-September 11th or the post-September 11th? And my inclination is to guess that, being that this is a race for the president, he's going to be facing serious questions, and these people know him very well and have covered him for a very long time.
New York is still a newspaper town, and there is no shortage of pre-9/11 reporters who still have a lot of string on the pre-9/11 mayor. Ellis Hennigan is a longtime columnist for Newsday. He agrees the relationship between Giuliani and the local press was combative, but he says it was also fun.
He didn't like us. I mean, let's just start with that. He didn't like to be criticized. He took it all very personally. He was quick to anger, and he lashed out very quickly, all of which made things fun for the media who had to cover him.
Lashed out how?
Well, he would complain. He would heckle you. He would question the intellectual honesty of your questions. In fact, of the Room 9 press conferences in his era, the most frequent beginning of a sentence was, if you were going to be intellectually honest about that question, you would blah, 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 blah. Yeah, it was a combative relationship. But in that combat, I think you learned a lot about who the guy was. He was someone who was very headstrong, who was not too big on nuance, who was smart and was a good arguer, and he might not be right, but he was never uncertain.
I'm just curious. Most of America knows Rudy Giuliani as the sainted hero of 9/11, but the New York press, you know, a very different take on him, at least through September 10th, 2001. What was the book on Giuliani?
In the early years, I think people appreciated the fact that he'd brought a sense of civic order to the city, and he rode that a while. But when he went to bed on September the 10th, 2001, he was just another tired mayor with a bad marriage. He had run out his string of charm in New York. He had succeeded in his years in office in alienating one by one an awful lot of the constituencies that add up to this place called New York.
Is it your sense that the New York media as a group is sort of champing at the bit to let the outside world know about their Rudy?
I think we have some insights that the rest of the world maybe hasn't tuned into yet. When you're with Rudy outside of New York, he's treated like a rock star. They show up in huge crowds and they ask very respectful questions. You know, 16 years into this relationship with the guy, that is kind of worn off in New York.
Part of running for office is managing the media. Now, Giuliani has taken some unorthodox steps in that direction in the past.
If you had to point to one symbol of the Rudy media relationship when he was in City Hall, it was the crime scene media police pen. The cops would come immediately after something really bad had happened and put up these blue sawhorses. And they wouldn't be right outside the building where the guy was killed. They would be like four blocks away from the building where the guy was killed. And they would do their best to hustle the media into that pen where you would have no connection to the story at all. It was especially maddening because you would see the delivery guy from the deli down the block coming back and forth at will while the famously aggressive and demanding New York press corps is sitting inside this little cattle pen halfway across the borough of Brooklyn. The trick, of course, was to start out at least by not taking out a press pass. Once you had that badge around your neck, some guy from DCPI, the Public Affairs Office at the police department, was sure to hustle you into the pen, and you were going to get nothing until you finally found a way out of there.
This is going to be a colorful race, I gather. Are you just tingling with anticipation about putting aside everything else, just the tabloid headlines?
God has never been kinder to New York newspaper columnists than he looks like he might be. And it's not just that Rudy and Hillary come from New York. I mean, that would be nice if that's all there were. But these are two large, divisive, almost cartoonish characters that you can't help but have a strong opinion about either one of them. My goodness, if we wake up in the morning sometime in the summer of next year and this race is between Rudy and Hillary, I truly will think I have died and gone to heaven. Savor the moment. Never let it in. Let them just beat up on each other for the next 30 years. I won't have to worry about anything else for the rest of my career.
Okay, Ellis. Thank you so much.
Sure. Great to be with you.
Ellis Hennigan is a columnist for Newsday. Wayne Barrett is a senior editor at The Village Voice. His most recent book is Grand Illusion, The Untold Story of Rudy Giuliani and 9/11. Barrett has been reporting on His Honor for the mayor's entire career, so I asked him what advice he would give the Washington Press Corps if, in 2008, they find themselves covering President Giuliani.
Never write a critical word. First advice I give. Never write a critical word. And Rudy is surrounded by what they call the yes Rudies. And so the press corps should see how well they pronounce the word yes. Right on, Rudy. Amen, brother. These are the terms that should just roll off the tongue.
Okay. Now, do you harbor personal animus to His Honor? And do you think the rest of the press corps harbors any such bad feelings?
You know, I was once quite friendly with him when he was the United States attorney. I probably had 20 meals with him, and in many ways I identified with him and loved him in some ways as a federal prosecutor. The guy I knew had extraordinary antenna for unethical conduct. It bothered him deeply. And then he ran an administration that had all kinds of ethical problems itself. And now he's built a multi-million-dollar corporation on the marketing of 9/11. So I don't know what happened to those antenna, but you know, I certainly don't think I have a personal problem with him. He's somebody who's on my beat that I've watched transform himself over time, so I report about him. But in many ways, I have a kind of feeling of fondness about him based on those years that we knew each other so well.
Now, that's kind of an ouch remark, the idea that Giuliani has exploited the memory of 9/11 for his personal gain. Do you suspect that will be an issue in the race?
I think in some ways it will. I mean, we already know that some of the families have said that they're going to go out to Iowa and New Hampshire and follow him and try to raise some of the issues about his conduct. So I think it could be an issue. Look, this is the first time we've ever had a serious candidate for president who's essentially running on the basis of what he did in a single day in his life. I think the other question is this: is the media really going to deal with the rationale for this candidacy? I know the media is ready to deal with Rudy, even in a critical way, on the questions of abortion, the gay issues, how they will float with the Republican constituency. But I've seen no interest on the part of the national media in examining Rudy's 9/11 record. It almost seems to be willing to accept it as a given.
The current administration may be the most secretive in U.S. history, and it's certainly as suspicious as any previous White House about the press. Knowing what you know about Rudolph Giuliani, should he find himself in the White House, do you think the transparency in the White House will improve, or what?
He thinks all information that government has is only to be given out on the press in a deal with a reporter where he gets a positive story is feedback. That's the way he's become, really, over time. It is going to be extremely difficult for the public to know anything about what's going on in the Giuliani administration, except that human sources may leak it. That's what we can hope for.
Okay, so the citizen in you does not want this man to be in the White House, but I wonder about the reporter in you. For professional reasons, are you interested in seeing him in this race, or aren't you?
Well, I teach a course up at Columbia Journalism School, and the dean introduced me as the only man in America who has more at stake in Rudy Giuliani's presidential campaign than Rudy himself. You know, I certainly intend to be a player in the sense that I intend to say what I have to say, write what I have to write, as he runs for president.
All right, Wayne. Thank you.
Thank you.
Wayne Barrett is a senior editor at The Village Voice.
Mayor Giuliani joins us now for Hannity and Combs exclusive. Should I say congratulations, Sean, or condolences?
A little of both, but mostly congratulations. This is a wonderful thing to be, you know, organizing and putting together, and it's a little very humbling to think that running for president of the United States is... Right. For a kid from Brooklyn, it's quite a step.
Coming up, many young Cambodians can't believe the tales of the killing fields, so young journalists are supplying the proof.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. When the power in Congress shifted to Democrats last month, so did the leadership of all the congressional committees. In both chambers, the Commerce Committee has purview over communications and therefore over a range of media issues from net neutrality to consolidation. On the Senate side, Republican Commerce Committee Chairman Ted Stevens ceded control to Democrat Daniel Inouye. It was Stevens, you may remember, who displayed an unusual gift for metaphor when describing the Internet.
The Internet is not something that you just dump something on. It's not a big truck. It's a series of tubes. And if you don't understand, those tubes can be filled. And if they're filled, when you put your message in, it gets in line. It's going to be delayed by anyone that puts into that tube enormous amounts of material.
Okay. As for the House, after a long break, Michigan Democrat John Dingell returns to the Commerce Committee chair. He's already slated hearings with the Federal Communications Commission for late next week. Dingell, who has served in the House for more than 50 years, has a reputation for strong oversight. John Dingell joins me now from his office in Washington. Chairman, welcome to the show.
I'm delighted to be here.
So can we start off with a relatively low-profile issue that still could dramatically change the cable TV landscape? Video franchising. For our listeners, basically the telephone companies, AT&T and Verizon, want to offer their own cable service to compete with Comcast and Time Warner and the rest. In December, the FCC voted to make it easier for phone companies to enter the cable market. But you say that the FCC overstepped its authority, and you've even talked about a legislative fix. How come?
Well, let's look at this. I favor the telephone companies being able to get into cable and into broadband service. I think that this is a very necessary step. What I'm saying is that the FCC has made several mistakes. First, they have not had a proper list of findings about public interest and the public convenience and necessity. Second of all, they have disregarded the law in asserting powers which the statute does not give them. And third of all, they have not addressed the broader questions which need to be addressed about seeing to it that consumers of these services are fairly treated. And this is a bit of an arrogance on the part of the FCC.
Fair enough. What about the issue of media consolidation? We've seen as many as eight radio stations owned by a single company in a single market. Your colleague in the Senate, Byron Dorgan of North Dakota, called the FCC's media ownership policies a spectacular failure. This is, again, the FCC's purview. They were turned away by the courts when they tried to loosen ownership restrictions. What do you think the role of the Congress is here?
First of all, I don't like that much multiple ownership. And that will be one of the questions in which the committee will be going, to see to it that we have enough competition that the consumers of telecommunication services are properly treated.
So you're looking toward perhaps a legislative solution to this problem?
We will be exploring that, because remember that localism, in other words, local service, diversity in media, are absolute essentials in seeing to it that the law is properly carried out. The FCC tends to be a bit slovenly on this. The court was right in overruling the FCC on ownership restrictions and the fact that they were fixing them too high. But the court's order in that case was not definitive, because it was on a number of issues, and the matter will now go back to the FCC for consideration.
Okay. Another big issue, one that we've talked about a lot on this show, is net neutrality. In a nutshell, internet service providers want to create a fast tier and a slow tier for information. And if you're an internet company with deep pockets, you could pay extra for your content to be delivered faster. Opponents say this violates the democratic spirit of the internet.
Well, the law requires that there be universal service. There's an honest question whether doing away with universal service and allowing special treatment of this kind conforms with either the law or with good public policy. This is one of the questions in which I intend to go in the committee, and it is one of the questions that has to be addressed to see to it that everybody, rich, poor, living in the good parts of town or in the poor parts of town, ordinary citizens and large data producers, are all fairly and properly treated. I happen to believe that seeing to it that there be network neutrality are extremely important, and I think that it is also extremely important that we require the cable companies or the new entrants into the cable business or the broadband business to do the build-out that is necessary, that they make competition available to every American everywhere, regardless of his means. And that's one of the defects in what the FCC is doing. It's one of the defects in what the telephone companies want. And it's not something I'm going to let them do if I can avoid it.
One last question. Obviously, next week, FCC Chairman Kevin Martin will face you, and you've expressed concern that while the FCC has overstepped its authority in some areas, it's a little too demure in others, notably when Commissioner Martin said that the FCC was not able to investigate whether phone companies were turning over personal phone records to the National Security Agency.
Well, we will have many questions. Mr. Martin. And these questions will relate to the kind of job he's doing, whether he's carrying out his responsibilities in protecting the public interest, and whether new statutory authority is needed. And all those matters will be gone into with considerable vigor and enthusiasm by the Commerce Committee.
But it is your position that the FCC ought to have been able to investigate whether phone companies had turned over those documents.
I would think that that is an absolute necessity to him carrying out his responsibilities, but we're going to ask him why he hasn't done so. And then we'll have a better answer for you.
Congressman, thank you very much.
You have a good day.
Michigan Democrat John Dingell is chairman of the House Commerce Committee.
Remember a few years back when word was leaked about a National Security Agency intercept of a September 10th, 2001 al-Qaeda email about an attack being nigh? Reportedly, the intercepted message wasn't read until September 12th. Here's another leak case, a CBS report about an FBI probe into whether AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, had a source feeding them information from inside the Defense Department. And yet another, the explosive whistleblower accusation that the NSA was wiretapping Americans in America. Two interesting things about those leaks, all great embarrassments to the Bush administration. One is that they were true. The other is, it turns out, that the White House, by its actions, actually told us so. This revelation comes courtesy of the upcoming Frontline documentary, News War. Early in the first of 4 one-hour films, which begin on PBS Tuesday, we see an exchange between reporter Lowell Bergman and Dave Zadie, former head of counterintelligence for the FBI, about the mechanics of a leak investigation.
Your office got the referral in the Valerie Plame case.
Yes. The FBI runs leak investigations when those leaks involve classified information.
How do you conduct these investigations? I mean, we read about them in the paper, but we have no idea actually what goes on.
Well, first of all, you have a victim agency, the owner of the information, those who classified it. What they have to do is file a report which consists of 11 questions. And those questions go from, was the material properly classified? Was the information that was leaked accurate compared to what the actual classified information is?
The information has to be accurate?
Yes.
So when the government announces a leak investigation and it comes to your office, it's confirming that the report in the newspaper, for example, or on television was true?
Yes. Indirectly, yes.
That's one way to fact check.
Yes.
I'll say. So next time you see the FBI chasing down a leak, know this. Even if the leaker is never fingered, the government surely is.
It's been 28 years since the fall of the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia, the murderous communist regime led by Pol Pot. Between April 1975 and January 1979, nearly 2 million people, about a quarter of the population, were killed or died from starvation, overwork, and disease. This year, a United Nations tribunal is set to try the leaders of the regime, at least those who are still alive. But as Megan Williams reports, there are many in Cambodia who are too young to remember and find it hard to believe what their parents say about those years in hell.
On the raised wooden veranda of a small home perched on stilts, the women of Mueang Vang sit and talk about the past. Mueang Vang is in central Cambodia, a tiny village just off a red clay road where palm trees shoot high into the sky. Ko Yin holds her infant grandchild in her arms. This 58-year-old was in her late 20s when Pol Pot took power. By the time the regime fell, her sister, brother, and husband were all dead, killed by the Khmer Rouge. Her two oldest children survived. The third, the same age as the child she now holds, died in her arms of starvation. Ko Yin is painfully aware that her older grandchildren don't believe her story.
They say, how is it possible that you ate so little? They say they haven't seen it with their own eyes, so they don't believe it when I tell them there was so little food, that we worked so hard, that people were killed. I'm angry they don't believe.
It's a grievance many survivors of the Pol Pot regime express. In Cambodia, there's been little public discussion of the genocide. Even after the regime fell, leaders still held key positions in government. Others, including Pol Pot, have died without facing justice. There's a real risk, say people like Vishwa Moili, that the country's brutal past is in danger of being denied or forgotten by the next generation.
I heard that you work in the field, rice field, and you got a lot of rice. So why you didn't have enough rice to eat? Like, it's very abstract when my parents told me.
Vishwa's 21 and works with the Phnom Penh group called the KRT, short for Khmer Rouge Tribunal Outreach Program. She and her colleague Nu Va spent 6 months traveling the country, interviewing young people about the Pol Pot past. They came out with a documentary called Seeing Proof. The film includes archival footage and interviews with survivors and their children. Throughout, teenagers express their doubts about the genocide.
I think it's hard to believe because they don't understand how Cambodians can kill each other. We are all good people and we have feelings. Why would they kill each other?
If there was such a regime, why didn't the people stand up and fight back against the leaders? They let a handful of people kill millions just like that?
Nu Va says high school students get taught practically no history of that time period. And for kids in the countryside, information is even scarcer.
Some of them don't go to school.
And now we don't have much about the Khmer Rouge regime lesson.
Nuva and Vishra are traveling around Cambodia again, this time to show the film. Vishra says people sit in silence and then ask to see it again.
Especially the old generation, they came up to say their past experience, they cried. And the little girl come up and cried as well, and just cried and said, "She very, very sorry to their old generation."
Across the city, two young radio hosts broadcast their weekly shows from the Women's Media Center. 27-year-old Dina Trapp hosts the Road of Law program, a call-in show that focuses on issues related to the upcoming Khmer Rouge Tribunal. It receives no government funding and struggles to keep on air with grants from foreign human rights groups. Dina says she uses different elements to trigger memories like this old Khmer Rouge propaganda music.
I start by playing the music and in the Pol Pot regime, and then ask to the young people and ask to the old people also, do you remember this song? Because I choose the popular song that in the Pol Pot regime always play in the morning.
Another radio program called The Truth aims to present nonpartisan information about the past in a way the government has failed to provide. It also offers an outlet to callers still suffering from that past.
The person who call in our program, most of them is the survivor of the Khmer Rouge regime. But however, we try to attract young people to listen to our program. Personal stories, this is what young people want to hear.
It's with us with every day, and not a single day that we forget to condemn the regime, that we forget to tell the children. It's been with us. It's a living history.
Yuk Chang is often a guest host on The Truth. He's the director of the Documentation Center of Cambodia and the nation's most vocal advocate for the victims of the Khmer Rouge regime. He's just finished the first textbook entry on the Khmer Rouge, and once approved by the government, it will at last become part of official history. He says that what always comes up when he hosts a show is how everyone, survivors and killers, feel victimized by the past.
So one time I was in between one killer and one victim from the same prison, and I was in the middle. When everybody, it doesn't matter they were perpetrator or victim, when they talk about food, they all cry.
Food,
it's so emotional. And people began to cry, and it just, and both sides, between the, even the killer, they feel that I was so hungry too. I would kill people because I want to eat food.
This mournful ballad is about Tu Slang, the infamous prison in Phnom Penh, where 14,000 children, men and women, were tortured under the regime. Their pictures line the walls, staring out into the former classrooms where they were held. The rooms have been left almost untouched, torture instruments sitting on bed frames, chains still bolted into the floors, bloodstains on the walls. As a final chapter of the Seeing Proof documentary, a group of high school students is shepherded through the former prison, the first glimpse at evidence of the Khmer Rouge terror. A survivor explains that children were killed along with their parents, a favorite Khmer Rouge motto being, "To clear the grass, you must dig up the roots." The teens' faces show shock and distress. Vuk Chang says that while it's tough for kids to face what happened, it's also what his country needs to finally heal.
It's just like a medicine. You know, it, to me, it's the most effective reconciliation process of all. Having children knowing so about what happened to their parent, I think it's the best healing. It's the best healing among all other processes that I have seen in Cambodia. It's the best healing. You know, the kids were just so happy that the kid went to the museum and tell them the story. They're so happy. They were so happy.
For On the Media, I'm Megan Williams in Phnom Penh, Cambodia.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director, and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Michael McLaughlin. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org. You can also sign up for our newsletter at that address, and you can email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.